This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, in what has clearly been a sad week because we've lost so many friends, Michael Nash from Tamament Library at New York University passed away unexpectedly.
Our friend Tito Gerassi, John Gerassi, Professor Gerassi, died on July 26th in a hospice at Beth Israel. He said to us, "I'm ready to go. I've had a long, good life." But that really didn't make it much easier. And we had him on the show 2 years ago to talk about the book, Unrepentant Radical Educator. We're going to play a short segment from our interview with Tito about the book.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, as our listeners probably know, you're the Executive Director of the wonderful National Lawyers Guild. And the National Lawyers Guild are oftentimes seen as those people with the green hats that monitor and report police abuse and help people who are in mass demonstrations. And again, you will be this year at both the RNC and the DNC, that's the Republican National Convention, and the Democratic National Convention. Now, can you tell us, first of all, what are the dates of those, and briefly, what are the Guild's plans? We're going to revisit this week after week because we want as many people as possible, and we want to talk about what the Guild's doing. But give us a sense, first of all, the RNC, which is first, I think. Where is it? In Timbuktu?
The RNC is the last week of August. It's actually the last 4 days of August. In Tampa, Florida. So it's going to be hot, it's going to be muggy, and the police department in Tampa has been reinforcing their supplies. They have a new tank. I think they have new suits for people to wear, police to wear, to protect them from tear gas. They put a lot of money into this, and we're afraid that we're going to see a repeat of the 2003 FTAA demonstrations where the term the Miami model was coined. I'm afraid it's going to be violent. The press has already started, along with the police department, issuing stories saying that, you know, violent anarchists are coming to town, the repeat that we see weeks in advance of every national special security event. So we will have a team of legal observers and lawyers on site to defend protesters during mass assemblies and if they get arrested, which we anticipate. Then we're on...
This is in Tampa,
that's
right?
In Tampa. Then, well, the RNC is technically the last 4 days of August. We anticipate protests starting several days before, so our crew will be down there for a good 7 or 8 days. Then we're off to Charlotte, North Carolina, where the Democratic National Convention goes from about September 1st to 4th, I believe. And I've heard rumors that the protests there will be larger than they usually are at DNCs. So again, we're going to have a legal office, legal observers coming from around the country to monitor police actions and to defend. We'll have lawyers on the streets to defend protesters when they're arrested. Our website, nlg.org, will have the numbers of our legal offices closer to the dates of those events. But if people have questions, they can contact us through numbers that are listed on the website before then.
Heidi, I know as part of your organizing for the DNC and the RNC, the Guild has issued a new set of Know Your Rights pamphlets, which is Know Your Rights in Demonstrations, vis-a-vis the cops, etc. They're great books. They're short. They're pocket-sized. They're colorful. There's one in Arabic. There's one in English. And there's about to be one in Urdu, I think. How can you get those?
We're coming out with one in Urdu and Bengali. I believe they're already up on our website, nlg.org. If you want hard copies of the one in English, go to our website, nlg.org, call our national office, and we'll mail you, if you would like, large quantities so that you can bring them to community group meetings or hand them out to your friends and colleagues.
Thank you.
many states, police obtain DNA from individuals who've been convicted of a crime and put them into a national database. The Supreme Court recently took up the issue of whether DNA could be taken from individuals upon arrest. What did they rule in this case?
Well, took up the issue is an interesting way to say it. What happened here was the state of Maryland passed a law that said that people that are arrested can be forced to have their DNA taken from them and put into a data bank. Now, that sounds just outrageous. I mean, people are arrested for all kinds of reasons and wrongfully for all kinds of reasons. We know this for stop and frisk, for example, in states all over this country. Do you mean to say that every time a person is busted for, like, my daughter putting her feet up on the seat of a subway?
Cheek swab
for having a joint or for jaywalking, that all of those people should be able to have their DNA taken, and particularly if the people, thousands of people, get acquitted or are never charged in the end.
And the problem is, do they return it, and how difficult it is to get that removed from the database?
I don't even know if it's allowed to be returned. But the point is, the Maryland law says that people who are arrested in Maryland have to have their DNA taken. Now, why should that population be any different than the regular person going down the street? Could they stop me walking down the street and have my DNA taken? There's no more reason to believe that a person arrested for very minor stuff who's not found guilty of anything is any more likely to commit a crime and should be in a DNA base. So it goes to your point that you were making a discussion with me, Heidi. Ultimately, they want the DNA on every one of us. So there you go. You have this Maryland law that says the DNA can be taken from someone simply because they're arrested. The Maryland courts, to their credit, said, we're going to stop that law from going into effect. We're going to hold that it's illegal to do that. And under the Constitution, I presume under the Fourth Amendment that it's illegal, perhaps under the Fifth Amendment as well, they stopped the law from going into effect. The government of Maryland then appeals to the Supreme Court. It's during the summer. The Supreme Court judges are, you know, vacationing in their sailboat somewhere. Judge Roberts garners a few of the judges from the courts. I think four of them is what it took. And he writes a decision essentially saying, yes, we're going to look at this case in the next term coming up in the fall. But for now, we're going to allow the Maryland law to go into effect, and DNA can continue to be taken from people once they're arrested. I mean, remarkable. It's not even argued. It's nothing. And they do that in the court. I mean, that's a terrible decision.
And it's a forecast of what their decision's going to be in the fall.
You don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind's blowing, Michael.
In what has clearly been a sad week because we've lost so many friends, Michael Nash from Tamament Library at New York University passed away unexpectedly.
Now, I knew Mike for a long time. He was the head of Tamament, which we all three of us have relationships with, which is the library that takes in a lot of what you would call the left, center-left, and labor papers in the United States as an archive. But it's not just a quiet, nothing archive. It's one that actively uses the papers, that has lectures and talks, gives access to them, has no particular ideology, so you get lots of debates. But all three of us have had relationships. Mine, of course, they have my papers there to the extent they mean anything, but they have the Center for Constitutional Rights' papers, and we were in the middle of finishing our negotiations with Michael Nash, who was the head of the library, who died really suddenly. He was in his young 60s. Michael Nash was really an important figure for all of us on the left, for all of us involved in labor. The archive was a major center of not only keeping documents from many of the political struggles of our generation and our century, but was an active place where there was much discussion, debate, etc. It had the Center for Constitutional Rights archives. We've been giving them, shipping over boxes all the time. It had Bill Kunstler's archives. Michael Smith will tell us about whose archives did they have, Michael?
Well, we just placed with Michael Nash Len Wineglass's archives. I remember attending a show there a few years ago with wonderful posters from the Spanish Civil War. I wrote a memoir about 20 years ago and had a book party there. And as I was speaking, I looked up and there was a huge bust of Eugene V. Debs on the bookshelf. It's a fabulous place, all the more so because of Michael Nash's contribution.
And Michael Nash was special because he could get along with everybody and get the archives from even completely opposite factions. So I had a great story one day because the woman who came over to my house, Cedric Belfrage's wife, Mary Belfrage, came over to my house. Cedric Belfrage was, at least for a while, a communist and certainly was sympathetic to the Soviet Union for many years, founder of the National Guardian in the United States. And he had died, and his archives had gone to Tamiment Library. So they're all there, very important. He was eventually deported from the country, as Cedric was. But his archives are at Tamiment. That day, Mary Belfrage had lunch with Mrs. Shackman. Now, most of our listeners probably don't know
Yetta Shackman.
Yetta Shackman was Max Shackman's wife. Michael can give us a little history of Max. But Max eventually, from starting on the left, moved far to the right, became a member of Social Democrats USA, wound up opposing U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam, et cetera, and became essentially what you call a right-wing socialist. What would you call him, Michael?
A right-wing social democrat.
Absolutely. Right-wing social democrat. So Mary Belfrage is over at my house. This is sometime in the 80s. She said, Michael, you know, I just had dinner with Yetta Shackman. She complained bitterly that her papers were in the same library as my husband, Cedric Belfrage. She thought it was like a sacrilege that these two sets of papers should be together. But this was Michael Nash, who could put these kinds of things together. And he was a worker on the street. I remember when we had to pick up the Kunstler papers, they were in a garage or something, and they sent out a pickup truck from Tamiment, which is part of NYU, and Nash is sitting there riding on the back of the pickup truck, coming in, going into the archives, which are half moldy, and saying these have to be put in this place because they're moldy. These have to go here. So he was just an extraordinary worker. And you know, when I was thinking about trying to write something about him, it came to me in some way. Of course, he was very sophisticated about politics and people, but in some way he was like a kid, because he was like a kid who likes to find treasure everywhere and it thinks if they keep digging they're going to find, like, you know, treasure or an old bone or a can or whatever. And he was like that about archives. That's why he loved archives so much. He was as excited about archives as you'd be about anything. And of course, one of his biggest coups, which almost got NYU in some trouble, was he got Philip Agee, former CIA guy who exposed the names of hundreds of agents and the CIA in a book called Inside the Company. He got his archives, what was there, in Cuba. He got them from Cuba and brought them back to the United States, but through Canada. And of course, the CIA was all over him and seized all the boxes in Canada. NYU had to wind up going to court on behalf of Tamiment. And to show how much credibility Michael Nash had, is NYU actually wound up fighting to keep the AG files at Tamiment.
I'd like to add that the National Lawyers Guild files are at Tamiment as well, and Michael, through the years, was just a lovely person to deal with. As you said, Michael, very hands-on, very curious intellectually, and really a gentle person and a wonderful spirit.
You know, I was there at the Tamiment one day. It's at the Bobbs Library. It's amazing to see a big private university like this have this set of left files. I was there the day that I think some 300 or 500 boxes came in from Brandeis. They had gotten money to buy the files that had been stored at Brandeis by the veterans of the Spanish Civil War, Republican files, but the Abraham Lincoln Brigade in particular. And all these boxes came in, and there was Michael Nash trying to go through the files, and there was everything in them. There were uniforms. There was even a gun they brought out of the files because they had never been opened. They were just sitting at Brandeis, these files from the vets of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. And those are also there. The Communist Party files are there. I mean, it's an extraordinary resource and an extraordinary loss, because I'm not sure of a couple of things. One, who has the kind of breadth of politics that could bring all of these various strands into the library? Who had the ease with which he could do that? And who could get along with the NYU administration while he was doing that? So it is a major loss.
I remember him asking me what the weather would be like, because he was going to rent a truck in New York City and drive up to the Catskill Mountains, up to Lenny Wineglass's place, which was on the top of a mountain, and he had to go through this washed-out driveway with a truck to get the files out of Lenny's basement.
Perfect example,
but he did,
Michael.
It.
Yeah. Look, this has been a bad few weeks for people on the progressive side and the left dying. Michael Nash, Tito Gerassi, and, of course, Alexander Coburn, as well as our friend Gus Reichbach, the judge. We won't say a lot about Alex, though there's a lot to say, particularly the way he just ate Hitchens alive, which for breakfast, which, of course, we like. But he also had a great statement about the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is we used to probably in every meeting we have, whether or every reception. Coburn described this in the 80s, I think 81, maybe 1981. He described the center as a, quote, splendid band of tigerish people. So thank you, Alex, for that wonderful quote. It still describes who we at least like to, who we are, or at least who we aspire to be.
He's brought in a lot of support for us with that characterization. I remember him from the 60s. He was a great 60s radical. He came to the United States from England. He was one of what they called the New Left in England. He was in a Marxist group there that had been kind of a reformation of people to the left of the Communist Party. Tariq Ali came out of the same organization. Our publisher, Michael Colin Robinson from Orr Books, came out of that same formation. He brought his political understanding and great wit and skill as a writer here to the United States. I remember reading his columns in the Village Voice. He got fired from that newspaper because he supported the Palestinians unconditionally. He went on to The Nation. He had two pages in The Nation. He had a whole center spread for a while, and they reduced him to one page. I think then they reduced him to zero pages, but then he came back after a while. He wrote for The Nation. I had hoped he would have written more for The Nation and was disappointed that they cut him back to one page. And then he started his own newsletter, Counterpunch, which you can get. Look it up online. Carries on the great tradition of really I.F. Stone's independent journalism with wonderful style. We'll miss Coburn. He was truly a very, very bright radical political analyst.
We often had disagreements on a number of issues. I think he was a little bit of a libertarian in certain ways. You know, I don't want to get it wrong, but I do remember one time when I opposed, I think, the first invasion of Iraq, when after Iraq took Kuwait, there was a lot of war calling, and eventually the U.S. went into Iraq and pushed it out of Kuwait. And I think, you know, the center brought lawsuits and opposed that war. And he wrote one great quote. He's such a snappy writer. And he said, Michael, even leftists dial 911. So that was his quote about my not supporting the Iraq war. Anyway, Alex, we really miss you a lot. I mean, to put it mildly.
He was very brave. He was sick for 2 years and didn't tell anybody. Kept writing to the end. Wrote his last column a week or so before he passed away.
Some very sad news. A good friend of yours and a friend of Law and Disorder, Tito Gerasi, passed away.
Our friend Tito Gerasi, John Gerasi, Professor Gerasi, died on July 26th of cancer in a hospice at Beth Israel. He had been sick for only a couple of months and died quickly. He said to us, I'm ready to go. I've had a long, good life. But that really didn't make it much easier for those of us who considered Tito a dear friend and comrade. Tito was truly a 60s radical. He was born in 1931, was an immigrant, and I'll get into that in a second, but he came to public notice in the 50s with a book about a homosexual scandal in Boise, Idaho, called The Boys of Boise. And then when his journalist career came to an end, he went out to San Francisco, and there he was a professor before becoming a political science professor at Queens College here in New York City. In San Francisco, he really lit the place up. He was an editor of Ramparts magazine, that great rebel magazine of the 60s. He was one of the leaders of the Bertrand Russell Tribunal on Vietnam. Vietnam was an illegal war launched by the United States, according to Eisenhower, to get the resources, the tin, rubber, tungsten, from Vietnam. They wanted to prevent Vietnam from gaining its independence. When the French were driven out by the Vietnamese, the United States took over. And Bertrand Russell, who was the most renowned philosopher in the world, agreed to assume the honorary chairmanship of the Bertrand Russell Peace Tribunal. And Tito was one of the leaders of it. He got his longtime close family friend, Jean-Paul Sartre, also a prominent philosopher and, like Russell, leftist, to be on the tribunal. And that's when he came to a lot of people's attention for his great anti-war work. He was injured by the police in a demonstration in 1968 during the huge student rebellion. A cop kicked him in the back, had that injury the rest of his life. He was red-baited and blacklisted and kept from teaching at San Francisco State for 5 years before his suit was settled, and he got his job back, but then went over to Queens. In the meantime, he had written an excellent biography, the first of a projected multi-volume biography of Jean-Paul Sartre called Hated Conscience of the Century. And his last book, a book called Conversations with Sartre, which Yale published and which has been surprisingly a good-selling book, very, very interesting, Conversations with Sartre. You know, he got his undergraduate degree at Columbia and then got his PhD at the London School of Economics. But before he became a professor, he was a journalist. He worked for both Time Life Empire, which was the major magazine chain at that time, and then he worked for the New York Times. He told us a wonderful story when he got the job with Time Life. The editor of Time Life was a man named Henry Luce. Henry Luce was like the Rupert Murdoch of his time. He was the czar of the magazine world. Tito went in to see Luce the first day of work, and Luce looked at him sitting behind a desk that was absolutely clear of everything. And he looked down on him from the desk, and he said to Tito, he said, "It is our belief that objectivity in journalism is neither possible nor desirable." So that was Tito's first lesson in how the world really works. Tito also worked for the New York Times. He went from Time Magazine to the great newspaper in New York, and he was sent down to Punto del Este in 1962 to cover the conference of the Organization of American States. That's where he met Che Guevara. It was that 1962 conference where the United States organized and had Cuba expelled from the OAS. Che wanted to interview Guevara, and Guevara told him, "I don't talk to the imperialist press." But they had a mutual friend, and the friend told Guevara, "He's okay." And from that point on, Guevara would sit down and talk with them when they had a chance. Guevara told a whole table of journalists and diplomats that Tito was okay. And Tito got the idea of writing a book, which he produced, became a sensational political book then, called The Great Fear in Latin America. What was the great fear? Great fear of the Cuban Revolution. Tito went from country to country in all of Latin America, and the entree that Che gave him by saying he's okay allowed him to write The Great Fear in Latin America. Tito came from a Sephardic Jewish father. His father, Fernando Gerasi, was a Turkish Jew. His mother was Ukrainian and Polish. He grew up in Paris. He told the story about his father, who became a general in the Spanish Civil War and the last commander of the troops that fought against Franco before Barcelona was lost in 1939. And Tito said that his father was sitting in a cafe with Sartre. His father and his mother were friends with Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. And his father was in the cafe when the newspaper guy came around hawking the headlines. The Spanish Civil War had broken out. Franco, the fascist general, had rebelled against the Democratic Republic of Spain. A civil war had commenced. And Fernando Gerasi got up from the table, went to the train station, arrived in Spain, and enlisted as a private in the army of the Republicans in Spain. He rose from a private to a general. I think that that influenced Tito very much, his father's politics and the heroism. Sartre didn't like what the father did. I said to Tito, didn't like it? Why? Because your father left a six-year-old boy and a wife? Tito said, no. He didn't like it because my father abandoned his art. His father was a great artist. He exhibited with Picasso, just fabulous abstract art. In fact, Tito got bounced from the art department at Time Life because he told Henry Luce. Henry Luce said, well, who's your favorite artist in current times? And Tito said, well, there's no question about Jackson Pollock, the abstract expressionist. It turned out that Luce liked Renoir and Manet. Tito lost his job with that observation. But in any case, Tito's father fought against the fascists, not only in Spain, but during the Second World War. He immigrated to the United States. The CIA tried to blackmail him and said, if you don't collaborate with us, we'll prevent you from getting your citizenship. So Tito and his family were not citizens for quite a long time. Finally, Abe Fortas, who was a friend of Lyndon Johnson's and who was on the Supreme Court, got Robert Kennedy to intervene, and they got the Gerasi family their citizenship. The second last book Tito did was called Unrepentant Radical Educator, which really summed it up. And we had him on the show 2 years ago to talk about the book. We're now going to play a short segment from our interview with Tito about the book. Tito is survived by two daughters, one of whom I know and admire, Lara Gerasi, who's a PhD student out in St. Louis. Tito, farewell.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Sitting here in limbo, but I know it won't be long. Sitting here in limbo, like a bird without a song. To roll, sitting here in limbo, got some time to search my soul. Well, they're putting up resistance, but I know that my faith will lead me on. I don't know.
We talk today with John Tito Gerasi, author of Unrepentant Radical Educator. The book encompasses the life, times, and activism of John Tito Gerasi. A lifelong political animal and radical educator, Tito has lived his critical pedagogy on the barricades and the front lines of the movement. As a newsman for Time, Newsweek, and the New York Times, as a blacklisted professor exiled in Europe, as a Korean War Green Beret, and as a best-selling author of The Great Fear in Latin America and 9 other books. Jean-Paul Sartre, a friend of his, said about him, "I trust no one more than Gerasi to make me understand America." Tito, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tito, let's just jump right into this. It's a wonderful book, Unrepentant Radical Educator, that you did along with an ex-student of yours, Tony Manchinsky. I wanted to ask you, because one chapter is better than the next, but you tell this great story about Henry Luce, the emperor of Time Life magazine media, like the current Fox News and the guy that owns that. That's what he was in those days, and you went to work for him. What did he tell you the first day about being a reporter for that empire?
Oh, when I finally got passed my tryout period, I was sent up to see him, and I walked into his office, and he had this enormous half-moon type of desk on which there was a blotter, leather type thing with two pens sticking out, an in and an out box. There was nothing in either boxes. And, you know, he had basically a squeaky voice, right? And he looked down at his blotter, which has nothing on it, and he said, I hear you're coming aboard, Mr. Gerasi. I said, yes, sir. I said, well, you know, we here at Time think that objectivity is neither feasible nor desirable. And then he looked up and I to my eyes and stared and said, any questions? I said, no, sir. He said, welcome aboard. That was it.
Yeah, well, but then later on, he invited you out to his house for dinner, didn't he?
Oh, that was later, yeah.
Yeah, and you really put your foot in it.
Oh, boy, and how I lost the,
you know, you could have been the art critic.
Yeah. In a way, because of what happened in my life, I'm glad I didn't. But for a while, I regretted because I could have. Art critic was a great job, right? You spent a day going to galleries, you spent a day writing it up, and that was it. And if you wanted to go cover a story in the Chicago Art Museum or San Francisco, you know, so you put it in and you got paid, you know, to go and so on. So at the time, I was very unhappy about that. But on the long run, I'm sure glad that was a great, great thing that happened to me, that I got kicked out of the art section. And the reason I got kicked out is because at that dinner, which is automatic, if you stayed at the Time for a year, you either get a huge raise, which I did, and you get invited for dinner at Luce's house, or you don't, and they just wait for you to leave because, or they transfer you around from section to section. I was a little disappointed. I thought I was such a smart ass that I thought that was me, right? I didn't know it was an automatic thing for anybody there. And so when the limousine came to pick me up, there was John McPhee, the New Yorker writer who got hired at the same time I did. Another guy who had, three of us had gotten hired the same week. And they were already in the limousine. So that was my first disappointment, right? And the second was that Art never came up, you know, during the dinner, except towards the end when Luce asked me, what did I think of Andrew White? And I said, I remember just two words, slick and sentimental.
Perfect.
And he nodded, you know, interesting. That was the end of the conversation on Art in front of everybody, right? All the managing editors and the business types, everybody was there. It was a big, enormous dinner. And all the wives. But the wives, the women in general, were not invited to the smoking room. That takes place after dinner for coffee, espresso, and cognac, and cigars. By the way, the cigars were Cuban cigars, right?
Of course.
He asked me at one point, what did I think of Jackson Pollock? And I said, I was America's first great classic painter. And he said, oh, really? And next day I showed up my office at 11 o'clock. We always worked late, came in relatively. 11 o'clock, I walk in, and there's a guy sitting at my desk. I said, who the hell are you? And he said, oh, you must be Gerasi. You're in Latin America. And I didn't know the difference at the time, the difference between Paraguay and Uruguay, nothing.
I didn't even know the difference between Latin America and
but I had put in before that shift to the senior editor, and he apparently had already approved it, a trip in Latin America, or specifically to Uruguay, to do a story on the Torres Garcia School, which I had thought I discovered wasn't very well known in the time.
Torres Garcia is a painter.
Yeah. I wanted to do a story, and I had suggested that I do art in Latin America in general, that I go everywhere. That still was approved, since it sort of combined with Latin America anyway. So both senior editors approved it. And so I got this fantastic trip throughout Latin America. And that was the beginning of my real radicalization. Because I began with Venezuela, where everybody adored, I mean, at the time, Perez Jimenez, the dictator, right? When I got there, I talked around. I went to a few galleries and so on. And there was one particular painting I remember at a gallery that I really liked. And I said, who's the guy? He's Manaure. I still remember his name, Manaure. And I said, well, well, can I interview him? He's in jail. So I said, well, with my time credentials, I might be able to interview him in jail. So I had to go to the police headquarters, and they said, sure, you're interviewing him as an artist, right? I said, right, as an artist, right? So I went to see him, and of course, he was one of the leaders of the resistance movement. That's why he was in jail, right? And he told me, passed me a little piece of paper to go see Patricio Ojeda at the university. So I went to Patricio and I was university, and I eventually found Patricio Ojeda. Patricio Ojeda was a 19-year-old student who eventually led the revolution that toppled Pérez Jiménez.
Amazing.
He was fantastic. I wish he had taken over instead. He said, you know, I'm too young. I can't. And he said, we got to have somebody that's really established and that will probably be respected by the world. And he chose Wolfgang Larrazaba, who then became the temporary president of Venezuela, and eventually allowed for a free election. Of course, it was immediately bought by the United States, and they put in Betancourt.
What year was this?
1958. Okay. It was really too bad because Patricio Ojeda was a fantastic guy. Eventually got killed, went to the hills, eventually joined the FLN in Venezuela, and eventually got killed.
Now, Tito, before we go from your first career as a journalist to your second career as a radical educator, talk to us about Che, because I know you met him in Uruguay and you became friendly with Che. And
there's an essay in here on Che.
Yeah.
It's called again.
But Che, where are you now that we need you or something?
Right. That's right. You were asked, can there ever be another Che, was the question that was posed to you, right?
Why would Che talk to you from the Imperialist Press?
I first met him much later at the Punta del Este conference. Punta del Este was where the Americans had called for, specifically Kennedy at the time, had called for a conference to start the Alliance for Progress. His Secretary of the Economy was his personal representative. Dillon was the one he sent down. And the one everybody was supposed to meet there at Punta del Este. It was 50 miles from Montevideo. It's a resort area of Uruguay with very fancy hotels and so on. And the representative from Cuba, which was then still part of the community and the OAS hadn't been thrown out yet, was Che Guevara. He arrived late. The New York Times folks, I was New York Times correspondent at that point, in Uruguay, but the regular, the big guys, Juan de Onís and Tad Schultz, knew that Che wouldn't talk to them. So to get rid of me, because by then they knew a little bit my politics, I'd changed radically since my time days, said, you cover Che, right? And so I went out to the airport. They all went to Punta del Este, and I was waiting for Che at the airport. Everybody came down, all the students came to the airport, and when Che arrived, they yelled at him, come speak at the university. So Che agreed to go to the university, so I did too. But there was an incident at that point. There was some anti-Castro Cuban exiles who had gone there, and they got into a fight with the pro-Castro students. As we came out of the, Che made a fantastic speech inside the auditorium, and as we came out, there was the rector of the university, there was a policeman, Che, of course, and me, because I was the only guy at that point with the credentials, right, for a newspaper, in this case, the New York Times credential. So he came out together, and there was this fight going on outside. The policeman panicked, took out his pistol, fired in the air. But there was an overhang from the auditorium, and the bullet ricocheted, and it hit a guy and killed him. And luck would have it that he was the representative of USIS. He was a Cuban, but working for American Propaganda Bureau, right? USIS, and he got killed, right? So I'm the only guy that sees it, the only correspondent that saw it, right? So I didn't go up to Punta del Este right away. I rushed to Press Wireless and sent my dispatch. And in brackets, I said, the witness is me. I was there, right? Yeah. New York Times ran the USIS story as it was issued by the New York Times, by the embassy, and ignored mine.
Yeah.
And so a big fight ensued and so on. But meanwhile, I go up to Punta del Este, and I'm supposed to cover Che. Che is booked into the cheapest of all the fancy hotels that were out there. And I tried to talk to him here, there, and so on. He says, yeah, I saw you at the auditorium, and so on, et cetera. But I don't talk to the imperialist press, and you're representing the imperialist press. Try to argue with nothing. And at this hotel, they had booked a huge table where all the left-wing characters sat around with Che. And there were all sorts of people there that were correspondents of some place. For example, representing Prensa Latina was a guy who had never been published before by the name of Garcia Marquez. Right? The representative from Monthly Review was Carlos Fuentes, and so on. You know, these guys, and Jorquera, El Perro, El Negro, we used to call him, who became Allende's press secretary, and so on. All of these guys who later became very important throughout Latin America were correspondents there. I tried to get to talk and nothing doing, right? So here they are sitting at a huge table, all talking. I got a table for me alone, as close as I could so I could try to pick up what they were saying. All of a sudden, Che jumps up and with arms open and greets a new guy who came, big hug. Turns out to be very close personal friends. Rogelio Garcia Lupo was his name. He was a correspondent for La Prensa of Argentina and had been a very close friend of Che as kids. They were the same age and so on. So Che eventually introduces him to everybody, pushes, asks the guy next to him to move over so Garcia Lupo can, Pajarito, a little bird we called him, could sit next to him. And as he sits down, he sees me way over there. And he says, Che Vos, what are you doing over there? Argentines say, hey you, Che Vos.
Yeah.
Right? That's how Che got his nickname, Che. But Che says, you know him? I said, yeah, he's a great guy. He said, well, he works for the imperialist press. And Garcia Lupo says, I work for La Prensa. That's even worse than the Times. Right? So they invited me over. Another chair had to be pushed, and I sat down next to Che on the other side. I was there for all the meals. They all took their meals together. And the last meal, at the last time before Che left, he's made all the people there. He said, by then he found out that I had gotten this incredible telegram, commissioned me to do a book on Latin America in general, which turned out to be The Great Fear in Latin America, right? That was published.
Best-selling book in those days.
But he turned around and he said, okay, you're going to go to all their countries? I said, yes. So he turned to the crowd and he said, I want you all to give me your word that you're going to show this gringo correspondent what the gringos never see. Take him around when he gets there. And sure enough, when I went to see Allende, for example, El Perro met me at the airport and took me and I stayed at the Casa Moneda while I was there and so on.
Let me get you back to this book. There is a chapter on Che. The book is called Unrepentant Radical Educator. We're speaking with what we call Tito Gerassi, John Gerassi, and we've been talking about Che. And just a simple question here on Che. It says the essay is called Che, Where Are You? And what was your answer to Che, Where Are You? This is after his death, I presume,
yes,
right?
Yes, right.
And what was the answer?
My answer was that eventually there will be many Ches. Don't worry. Latin America will eventually win, I said to my students. Right?
And how many years ago was that?
10 years ago.
All right, a good answer. Heidi?
Oh, a chapter that I think we all enjoyed is titled Albert Camus in Action, Dissension or Abstention. And you talk a bit about Camus and Sartre.
Yeah, eventually, that originally was a chapter to be part of a debate between the pro-Sartre and anti-Camus and pro-Camus. And it was commissioned by the Chicago University Press. But the guy who was the editor of it, who was to put it together, was so pro-Camus, both in his own introduction and in his choice of articles, that Chicago decided not to publish it. It was eventually published by somebody else, I don't remember who. But that's my article, and it was basically an answer to another article that was pro-Camus that was written by a student of mine, who by then had graduated, was teaching philosophy in somewheres in Illinois, I think. So my article was never published, right, and excluded from there. So I sent it to France, and it was Sartre sent me a little note saying, I can't publish it. You're too pro-me. It looks like a puff job and so on. But we'll send it over to Esprit. Esprit was a French Catholic, but extremely liberal and almost like could be said leftist publication. It had been started by Mounier. Mounier was the head of the resistance during the Second World War, the non-communist resistance. And he had traveled to England to talk to de Gaulle at de Gaulle's request. And what apparently de Gaulle told him was, yes, go ahead, make the alliance with the communists. And so he came back. He was betrayed by somebody. Sartre always believed it was a communist who betrayed him. Was caught by the Germans, and he was tortured to death by Klaus Barbie.
Wow. I think.
But the article appeared.
Tell us about, you know, this debate. I mean, maybe all our listeners don't know, but the issue between Sartre and Camus, which, you know, I interpret in some way as, you know, a person who says life is absurd, you know, Camus and what's the purpose and all this, and Sartre, who's a person of action and, you know, talks about it differently. But what is that debate? And that's what you take on here. You take on Camus's, you know, novels, and particularly The Plague and The Stranger. But what is the debate?
Well, the debate really has began with a choice that Sartre had to do. Camus was part of the group that created the Temps Moderne, the Modern Times, the French magazine that was directed by Sartre. Malraux was a member before he became a Gaullist. There was all sorts of intellectuals that had agreed to create this magazine. And one after another fell out if they didn't accept the choice that Sartre made. And Sartre's choice defined the magazine from then on. And what he said was, yes, it's terrible what's happening in Russia. Yes, we will denounce those trials that bring all the intellectuals and execute them, et cetera, et cetera. But we live in a time of very risky where the Third World War is possible. Which country is capable of starting World War III? Only the United States. Russia would never start World War III. He didn't even know at the time that the United States had a first strike policy and Russia didn't. Right? But he just, from analyzing the situation in the world, he said, the United States is capable of starting World War III in order to dominate the world. Now, it is true that at the time, everybody, Russians and Americans and the Temps Moderne people, thought that if there is a Third World War, and it's an atomic war, the radiation dissipates in the atmosphere and disappears. So that although it was clear that an atomic bomb could blow up all of Moscow, it wouldn't necessarily mean the end of the world. Right? That became known much later, in part thanks to the trial of the Rosenbergs. Right?
But I would say this leads into your story in the Rosenbergs.
Right, exactly.
But anyway, so Sartre said, Russia is capable of starting World War III.
Russia's not capable. U.S. is.
Right. Russia's not. The United States is. And in addition, in France, locally, the Communist Party represents the workers. You know, 90% of the unionized workers were members of the CGT. CGT is communist. Right? We cannot go against the communist orders when it affects working conditions in France. Right? They represent the workers, and that's what the workers want. So for those two reasons, we are going to support the communist forces in France and on a world scale. Now, Camus, of course, denounced that. Camus ended up taking the position that he can't support anything. The only thing he was asked point blank at one point, well, what are you in favor of? Republican Spain. This isn't in the 50s, right? I mean, Republican Spain doesn't exist, right? Eventually, the breakup got to the Temps Moderne in print because Camus was ignored. They did not take back the criticism on the myth of Sisyphus, where Camus had the position that life is pushing the rock up the hill, letting it fall back and pushing it back up and so on, and identifying with the effort of pushing the rock up the hill like Sisyphus did, right? Nor did the Temps Moderne have second thoughts about The Stranger. They considered it a first-rate novel, and they stayed that way. But all of a sudden, Camus starts publishing strange things, like, for example, The Plague. The Plague is a sort of allegory about German occupation. But it says the plague comes to this country. Nobody can do anything against the plague. There's no explanation why it came, no explanation about anything about the plague. Nevertheless, the doctors fight against it. And in Camus' novel, they continue to fight against it. All of a sudden, the plague goes away. And the Talmudian's answer was, you can't claim that the Germans came, we can't explain anything about it, and then the Germans go away. The Germans are the creation of conditions that existed in France and in Germany and so on in the world. That's why there was a Second World War. And they don't go away because resistors kept doing the resistance. They go away because they were defeated. And they were defeated in part because the Allies and in part because of the resistance. And finally, what happens is that Camus writes what is considered his major work, at least by those who love Camus, which is The Rebel. The Rebel ends up saying that you can never find a justification for violence. Sartre says the counter-violence is very often the only way to defeat the violence. The violence is always started by those who have power, to increase their power, never started by ordinary people on whom it's affected. Therefore, counter-violence is always something positive and is directed against the ruling class, which tries to impose its way. And today in the world, counter-violence is directed, even if it's roundabout way, against a policeman over there. Nevertheless, it's against the ruling class in America, which tries to dominate the world. And of course, Camus said, no, absolutely not. It's better to be always opposed to violence than to try to figure out who is a better position.
Tito, a few days after the events of 9/11, you wrote a short yet really poignant piece that you said the New York Times refused to publish as an op-ed piece. So a friend put it on Z Magazine, and it was translated into over 57 languages. I found it a very moving piece. Can you describe it briefly?
Thank you. Yes. It was motivated by sort of friends, acquaintances. These were the firemen on my block. I lived on 10th Street between Greenwich Avenue and 6th Avenue and West 7th Avenue. And at the very corner of Greenwich and 10th Street was a firehouse. And it was a small one, and there was only 8 firemen on duty, plus the regulator, on any one of those shifts. They were very close, right? So when the alarm went off, the 8 of them took off immediately, and they were the first firemen that were at the World Trade Center site, and they all died, every one of them. But before we knew that they had died, there was a call made in the street by the street organization, in part that they had organized, because they used to come around and say when they see an old woman dragging her bags, they would help her. But if they couldn't help, they would say to other people, why don't you guys organize something to help these old ladies that live there? There were a lot of, from the days that this was an Italian neighborhood, old Italian widows. And so there was this kind of understanding between various people. I knew then more people in the street and were more friendly and knew about their lives than I do now in a high rise of the people that are on the elevator every day. But one of the noises that went around is that we have to give blood for these people. And so I went the very next day, 9/12, to the hospital that was nearest to me, which is St. Vincent, which is 2 blocks away. There was a line to give blood, and I got in line. But, and I'm talking to the guy in front of me, who's a Cambodian. And we start talking about Pol Pot and this and what's happening in Cambodia and all that and so on, etc. And he turns out to be a guy that's very political. He says, you know, Pol Pot is the result of American intervention in the area and so on. But still, you know, he's there not to give blood to America. He's there to give blood to firemen. So when I came home, I sat down and wrote up the article. I said about this, you know, that what I was watching on TV and what I was seeing in the streets and what I remembered about the firemen. So that was just a real story from the heart, so to speak. I was really very upset that the New York Times didn't run it. Right? I didn't go in there very much. I didn't accuse the United States by name of being responsible for the disasters of the world. You know, just concrete what happened that day.
The piece, just for listeners, is called Will the Tears Ever Stop?
And it's from John Jurassic's new book, Unrepentant Radical Educator, a collection of his articles and interviews, some of the interviews done by Tony Monchinsky, a former student of yours, Tito.
An Unrepentant Radical Educator. I want to recommend, if people want to hear more of these amazing stories and views about politics, which are utterly incredible, to get this book, Unrepentant Radical Educator, John Jurassic and his co-author who interviewed him and wrote some of it.
And it's published by Sense Publisher. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tito. Great to talk to you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.